Rosalie Crosby of 617 West French Street, Traverse City, Michigan, zip code 49684, telephone 946-8711, is recording her experiences during World War II. Rosalie was with the Red Cross. Is that right, Rosalie?
Yes.
This is June 20th, 1984. Elsie Hornbacher is the interviewer for the Lansing unit of the Women's Overseas Service League. Rosalie, you're no longer connected with WOSL in Traverse City, are you?
No, there's no club or organization up there.
I see. Mm-hmm. But we were real happy to see you the other night at our patio party after all these years apart. You were with the Red Cross.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I joined the Red Cross in June of 1945.
1945?
Yes. And had the training in Washington, D.C. and Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and went overseas early in July of
1945.
And the war had ended.
That was the end of the war.
It was towards the end of the war. The war had ended in Europe, but it was still going on in the Pacific. And I went over on the Queen Elizabeth. Went up the Firth of Clyde in Scotland and crossed over in England. Then we took an exchequer across to France and Le Havre. They held us over a day in the before they let us go ashore, because there were still mines in the water there in the
English Channel.
In the English Channel, right? And we were a few days at Le Havre. They put us on a all night train to Paris, and we were there. Well, let's see, it was the celebration of the,
What month?
This was July yet.
Oh, July, uh-huh. Then wouldn't that be comparable to our American Revolution there?
Yes.
What is that name? Do you remember it?
That slips my mind. We danced.
Bastille Day.
Bastille Day, that's
right.
Right.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. I was over there during it. That's how I happened to remember a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
And from there, we were assigned our different where were different ones were going to go. I was sent to southern France at Marseille, and then I was on the staging areas. We had, but at first they were sending the soldiers over to Japan and the Pacific, but the war ended in August. Then they sent them home, of course, from there.
Okay. And this wasn't an occupation country like Japan or Germany. And I suppose the boys stayed in France for some reason?
Well, they were stationed there at this staging area.
Oh, but it wasn't an occupied country?
Not yet.
Okay.
No.
Never
not
was.
At all. Never
France.
Was, no.
Mm-hmm.
And there were five Red Cross, they were just wooden frame structures, mm-hmm. set up in a hurry. And thousands of soldiers, of course. We just couldn't do very much in the way of recreation, just more or less giving them donuts and coffee, and because there were so many of them. And I was there that summer and fall until almost Christmas, and they closed out the staging areas pretty much.
This would be 1946 then, or 1945? Yes.
This was 45.
45, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
How long did you stay there then, Rosa?
I was it was still in 1946, and then
You came home in 46?
No, no. I was from there, after the staging areas closed out, I was on the, they were beginning to send the soldiers over for occupation forces. Mm-hmm. I was put on the dependent trains, where they met the soldiers' wives and children at Bremerhaven and Bremen, and then we took them on the trains to five different areas all over Europe. One train went to Berlin, one to Paris, one to Heidelberg, Vienna. We can't recall a fifth train that we would pick up, take the brides and or their wives, children to the soldiers that were stationed there, and that had decided to stay a while over in Europe, and then we would pick up the war brides and take them back so they could go back to the States. And I was a train hostess at that time. For 6 months I did that.
You mean you rode on the train?
I rode the trains, and we rotated as to which train you would ride. And I rode I met the first boatload of women that came over.
Were there any particular memorable experiences you had during these train rides to the different cities with the war brides and so forth?
The first train that I rode was the Berlin ride. It was, and we met the first boatload of women and children that were coming from the States for the soldiers. This was written up all of the United States, and there were reporters there and photographers from all the leading newspapers and magazines, and Life magazine, a couple of reporters from Life magazine were there on our train, took all kinds of pictures, and they met the women, of course, with a lot of fanfare, and there were bands playing, and they gave them corsages, and of course the children were all sick and they were crying, and we Red Cross girls, there were five of us. No, there were more than that at first, because there were three girls to a train. Later on, they reduced it to just one girl to a train. So, these women, of course, were all tired and everything, so we had all kinds of things to give them at first, you know, Kleenex and toothpaste and pop and all kinds of...
These products weren't available on the European markets.
No, so they were happy to have them.
As I remember, we couldn't even buy a bobby pin
right
in Japan.
So, so we had rode this train to Berlin. We had to go through the Russian zone. It was about before you went into Berlin, and they slowed the trains down to about 15 miles an hour. And the Russian soldiers came on the trains, walked through it. I don't know if they were inspecting, but. So we were late for about, maybe 6 to 10 hours. Real late, the train getting into Berlin. And the soldiers, of course, were all waiting in the station there. And with one voice, they all, "Where have you been?" You could almost hear it. And they didn't wait for the women to get off the train. They just piled onto the train. I was squished up against it. It was real exciting. And, they were so happy to see their wives.
In 1945, we were still friends with the Russians.
Yes, but they were still quite suspicious, more or less, and as I say, they had to inspect the train.
Oh.
They walked through it, you know, they got on the train, that's why it was stopped, and they were very...
And that's right, a part of Berlin was assigned to
the
Russians.
Yes, right. And I had 3 days in Berlin then to look around before the train went back, and...
So. Was there a great deal of rubble there?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What would you say, a fourth of it was just destroyed or less? Or, just
at least
estimate.
A fourth.
Uh-huh. At least a fourth of it was destroyed.
Yeah. And you saw the women in the streets kind of cleaning, trying to clean up with the rubble, you know, and picking the...
Do you think the people had enough to eat there?
I think
it was Germans.
Yes. No, I think they had trouble getting food. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very much.
Did you notice any effort by the Germans to get out of Berlin at this time?
Not so much. I, of course, wasn't there
in the
right
city,
in the city
yes,
very
I
long.
Can understand this.
And they seemed to be dazed, more shocked yet, you know, type, and the looks on their faces and mm-hmm. so forth.
Did they make any effort to contact you verbally or?
No.
Mm-hmm. They were off issues, though.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Frankfurt was also badly damaged, mm-hmm. and all whole sides of the building were off and everything. And even after that, I was there in 46, you see, and that was nearly a year later. And still, sometimes you could smell odd.
Human.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to
human corpses.
Clean it up, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was able to travel all over Europe where our men were stationed, where the soldiers were stationed, during that 6 months on the trains. They kept reducing the number of girls that worked on, so that by the end in October, we had started this in early in the spring.
At 45?
Yeah. This is 46.
46, okay.
And by the end, there was only one girl to a train, and we didn't have any supplies to give them. You know, the...
No Kleenex?
No, nothing.
Back
and
in those days,
it got to be kind of
there's a shortage of toilet paper,
yeah,
and
right.
Kleenex came in handy.
And after a while, they took the Red Cross girls off completely,
mm-hmm.
and they could fare the best way they could, getting to
I see
the year. I was assigned from there to Salzburg, Austria, to a Red Cross club. And there's where I really did much more recreation and planning of that.
What did you do before you were in the service?
I was always interested in recreation. I started planning collecting games and planning parties from the age of 14. And worked. I was sent when I was 17 from the church to a national recreation training for a few weeks. And I started a business of my own in planning parties and evenings, and advertised in a local paper. Would just more or less did it on from my own experience. I was always interested in dramatics, and was in several of the Lansing Civic plays, and in took a course in the radio drama at the college, Michigan State University. I had sufficient...
That's in East Lansing.
Yes, in East Lansing. They, when I was interviewed for Red Cross, they thought that I had sufficient background in recreation so that I was taken in.
Do you happen to remember what your pay was overseas?
I was paid $150 a month plus expenses.
I see.
And
then where did you sleep? Did you have a hotel to stay in, or
some places we had hotels and given rooms? The accommodations were pretty good.
Did you have a home base? What was your home base?
It depended on where I worked.
It varied from month to month, is that it?
Well, yes, sir, I was changed from when I first went to France and to Southern Bay. I think I changed two, three, well, we were at Aix, France.
Mm-hmm. Aix, France, is that near, is that
Southern
France?
France, but we had to ride 20 miles to the staging areas every day and back and forth on trucks.
How did you ride, in trucks?
Uh-huh, and mm-hmm. rattled around on a truck. And then when I was sent to work inland, off the staging area, I was living in a hotel for a while, and we had a little club for the officers at first. And then anyway, I moved about three times at the time I was in southern France. When I was sent on the trains, they first had us they gave us a nice, all of the Red Cross girls in a kind of a house, you know, we had the place. We didn't have that very long. They decided that was too expensive, I guess. So they set us up in Frankfurt. And that was we had just rooms in the hotel there. And, but of course we were riding trains back and forth all the time. When I was in Salzburg, Austria, we were set up in a hotel, in a room. And then also there were others. There were, my roommate was a girl who was, she was not in Red Cross. She was a librarian. She worked on a mobile truck, you know, that went around to all the different small towns. She drove the truck and had it. I was trying to think what she was. Must have been the wax or something. I don't know just what her. So that we were billed with other services, not only just our own.
She was probably a Department of Army civilian.
That's what she was.
Right, that.
I couldn't quite think. And of course, in Salzburg, the actual Red Cross Club had been a former gambling casino. It was a beautiful building, three floors, a great big ballroom, and then we serviced men that were coming over there in the occupational. Many of them were much younger because they were 18, 19 year olds, and most of them hadn't had any war experience than they hadn't been in. We had all kinds of facilities for them. There was a barber shop there, and there was game rooms with ping pong, and there was reading rooms where they could be quiet, and we had a program going constantly of
different activities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Back in 1945 and 1946, $150 a month was a pretty good salary, wasn't it?
Well, it,
maybe
yes,
a
it was.
Above average.
In that, it was average.
Average.
Mm-hmm. Some of the girls that went into Red Cross had to take cuts in pay because they were getting much more at home. With me, it wasn't so bad. With your board and room taken care of.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
You had extra money. I sent money home and to my mother. Mm-hmm. All the time.
Actually, all of your personal belongings could probably have been put in a footlocker over there, couldn't have they?
Yes, we traveled around with a footlocker.
Traveling to that extent.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. I was trying to think.
Do you have any funny experiences over there?
Well, I jumped off a moving train. I was on the wrong train when it started out. We were talking to one of the other girls, and so it just started very slow, but I thought I could get off in a hurry, and I took a flying leap and sprawled on the pavement. Didn't hurt myself too much, except my pride, of course, but I got off that train in a hurry. So then another time we had these pot-bellied stoves in the Red Cross clubs, and this was
no
here, still
central
down.
Heating systems over there,
and not in those clubs in southern France. They're just wooden shacks that are built up, you know, set up. So this was, and I was cold, and I had kind of a raincoat type on, and buttoned up real good, and had my purse over my shoulder, so it kind of, I was standing too close to the stove anyway, and I felt pretty warm. And of course I did the thing you shouldn't do. I started running. Someone grabbed me and beat the flame out, ruined the coat, but I was saved.
Did you have to pay for your clothing up there?
We had, I remember I drew $500 out to go into Red Cross. We had to buy our uniforms, yes.
Oh, you did that.
And of course, Red Cross didn't get any, we were civilian. We weren't considered Army, so we weren't, when we got home, we weren't given any special benefits like the. So some of them, you know, thought that it was a little underpaid or something. They didn't get so much, but...
Had Salzburg been bombed?
No. No, it was intact and very nice. And a very picturesque place, and often saw them wearing their native costumes. And we had...
The Lederhosen?
Yes, And we had entertainment all the time in the Salzburg Club, and we had these folk dances, and that's where I first saw folk dancing and native dances.
You utilized the talent of the Austrians, didn't you, then?
Yes, and
the musicians,
we had 150 Austrians dancers. Working for us. About five girls are running the club with 150 staff to took care of the cooking and the serving. And the, in fact, of course, there was one man that was the head over these. He was very... very bright, and most of these...
An Austrian supervisor for the entertainers?
Yes. And all you had to do was tell him what you wanted, and he just had it done. We could change... Every week we changed a theme for our dance or something. You know, we'd have Western or New York City or something, or Hawaii or some theme. We wanted... they would... They had artists in the... working for them, and the next thing you know, you had a whole stage set. I mean, they just had it all beautiful for you.
Did the Austrians seem to appreciate you Americans being there?
Well, yes, they acted as if they did. They were having a very rough time getting food, so that every so often we would have to shake down the staff. They were naturally sneaking out food to their families who were having a hard time. And I didn't blame them. I might have done the same thing, you know. They could have food themselves, but they weren't to take it home. And that was rough when you see your own family. But they had to be strict or we'd have lost, you know, you can't run things with them just taking it blind. Also, the black market was rampant, of course. And they would get, there was nothing to buy in the stores. You couldn't see anything. Just paper goods. I didn't see how they ate. You know, there was no food, no clothing, and all of it black market.
Did they appear? They had shoes, didn't they?
Yes.
Most of them. Were they warm? Did they have enough clothes to keep them warm?
I don't know. I know they wanted blankets badly. And
they wanted blankets. Coats, any old clothes.
Anything. Oh, they were having troubles. And
this is the Austrians.
Yes, and Germans, of course,
now.
Too.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You're right across the border from Bavaria there in Austria.
When I was, after the soldiers were pretty well sent back home in December of 1945, then I was assigned from then until spring to a unit of soldiers who were investigating the graves and the identities of the soldiers that had died overseas, killed. And so that was about 3 or 4 or 5 months that I was there when we were had just small Red Cross Club. There was only two of us girls working on that.
Where is this again?
This is in southern France, Aix.
Aix,
France. And then we didn't have any, of course, girls for the dances for the soldiers. So we went to the town mayor and interviewed and headed the college there. And we had an interpreter. We asked them to, if they would, we could, you know, send their girls who were interested to the dances with our soldiers, and they were very happy. So we recruited about 100 girls a week. They would bring them in their own buses, and many of them couldn't speak English, but they managed to have a good time at the dance. And so in that way we worked with the community, and they were very, they always sent chaperones, and we had a lot of nice dances that winter and in the spring, into the spring.
You bused the girls then back home, didn't you?
Yes, we always got them back, and they always had to be a lot of supervision, you know, several people coming with them. We had an assigned, a young man assigned to us anyway, who was our interpreter for anything we wanted in the town or anything. I got to see the Mardi Gras in Aix, France, which is the father, I guess, of the Mardi Gras here, you know. I mean, that they patterned it from in New Orleans after this one that they had there, which they carry on a celebration that's in the spring, and they carry it on for several days, and that was a lot of fun. During the fall of 1945, while we were still had the fellows there waiting to go home, they were so restless and so unhappy, and the process was very slow. But we couldn't do much of anything to make them happy. We had, I remember, the World Series in October, and so we decided we had one little radio. Or at least one electrical outlet for it, and we had that set up in the club with some speakers on it some way to make it so more could hear. But the club got filled up so that another soldier couldn't even squeeze in there, and they were standing outside the window. We had it in a window, so many of them outside, of course, couldn't hear anything. One of the fellows decided that. And told me that maybe we could move that radio a little bit so they could hear outside. And so we went to the trouble of doing it all, and well, the soldiers outside could hear, but then the ones on the inside couldn't, and they were so angry. And I knew I couldn't try to please them anymore, so I went and hid, because they were having they weren't about to be happy about what I had done. And I was afraid I might get hung or something.
Can you account for the reason for their only having one radio?
We may have had more. I don't think they had any more outlets than that that they could connect it. And,
and no batteries?
Any batteries available, you know, to have a battery. And so that we only had one radio in the club. Now, I don't know whether some of the soldiers might have had something, but it was... hard for them to get any news, of course, from home, you know, making anything. They had a strike at one time early in December. I can recall them
what
coming
year
down.
What was this?
45, the winter, or this fall of 45 and into, while they're waiting to be sent home after the wars that ended everywhere.
They had a strike? What did they
yes,
do?
They walked down in about 20 across and rows of them. They came, I don't know, they were going to tear up the the headquarters where they were assigning them or something.
Because
they didn't
they
think
weren't
they
were going
they
home.
Weren't going home fast enough, and they thought there was somebody was dragging their feet or something. But somebody they had quite a time quieting them down, and I don't know.
There were hundreds or thousands of them.
It seemed like there were hundreds of them, and of course there was thousands on that staging area, but a lot of them.
What is a staging area?
It is where their boys are sent to after they've finished one assignment or through with their, and they're waiting for the next, where they're going to be sent next. And the staging area on Marseille, of course, they just had tents all around and waiting for their, to be assigned, to be sent.
The men were sleeping in tents?
Yes, and
was this in the summertime or winter?
Yes, and of course it's warmer there anyway all winter. But it was just kind of red dust, you know, the sand. It wasn't kind of like a clay, just clung to everything. It was hot. No trees or anything. They sent us Red Cross girls a few times to Nice, France for 3 days. There was an American, she was an American woman and an English woman that owned this castle on the Mediterranean, and for kind of a relief. But of course, the soldiers didn't get any such
treatment.
treatment, no. But a staging area is where, when I first went there, they were being sent, being processed to go to Pacific because the war was over in Europe. And when the war ended in the Pacific that summer in August, they were sending them home from there. But they just had to sit there and have nothing to do for them and wait until, of course, and they were so sick of war and wanted to get home so badly. So I don't know if that was the term they used in the,
mm-hmm.
as an area where they, but there were thousands and thousands of soldiers. And as I say, we couldn't do anything. They couldn't even sit down in the clubs. They just went through and stood up and drank their coffee and ate their donuts and went on so somebody else could have it. It was that crowd.
What kind of work were the soldiers doing at this time, or were they just waiting?
Just waiting. And they know waiting is awfully hard to do.
Oh, yes, hurry up and wait was
yeah,
the old Army
right.
phrase.
No, they were not. Some of the fellows were helping us, you know, that felt like it. And we had a lot of...
There were no activities planned for them other than at the club.
No.
Did they wander around town and whoop it up?
Well, they were pretty well...
Wasn't anything to whoop up downtown,
no,
was there?
No, and, you know, they weren't allowed too much to wander out
oh,
around.
Oh, they weren't? Oh, they had
yeah.
to stay more or less within
yes,
a certain
uh-huh.
given
yeah,
area?
Yeah, they didn't want them
They
know,
didn't have a jeep?
The
they couldn't travel?
No.
Well, this
we
is
had,
distressful.
We had some on the staging. I was given, as they came, we were given... Us Red Cross girls, they couldn't take a lot of things on the boat. I was given a jeep and three typewriters and guns, I think a couple guns. And, you know, they had to... One fellow was, I remember, quite... he took his jeep apart and sent it in pieces home something. But they couldn't take these things with them on the boat, and they didn't want to do them, so they gave them gifts to us Red Cross girls. Well, I had this jeep for a while, but of course, after a while, the Army came
it?
And picked it up.
Oh.
Well, they didn't. The men had taken all these things from the Army and from the... when they went through Germany, of course, they just ransacked the homes and took mm-hmm. all kinds of things.
They ransacked homes.
But oh,
we
yeah.
were wondering before, when you were saying about the men waiting, how long did they have to wait?
Some of them waited for months from, you know, from in the fall or early summer or something. And then they were given, you know, they had to wait their turn. Those who had been there the longest went first or something. But there was all kinds of red tape and holdups. Some of them were there for months and nothing to do. And so they got pretty stir crazy.
I can understand that.
They were very upset there. Did I repeat that I saw, was it the Mardi Gras? And
yes.
Yeah, I said that.
Mm-hmm.
Skipping back to the Red Cross in Salzburg, Austria, I met General Eisenhower. He visited our club in the Red Cross, and he and several other generals, lesser stars. Most of the girls, staff were following the general around, you know, and sticking pretty close to him. So I kind of entertained lesser generals. He had a three-star on his cloak. And so when we were standing outside, it was quite chilly. And he took his cloak off and put it on my shoulders. So afterwards, the soldiers kidded me a lot, called me general. And then I also met the Duke of Windsor while I was in southern France. He went through with his troop. Well, he had a lot of cars and long traveling with him. They stopped there to get gas and supplies. And I was quite a little ways. I was sitting on the porch of the hotel there. One of the soldiers said he knew him. I'm way there now. But he took me, he said, and I had a little camera, a little box camera, and he said, do you want to take his picture? And I said, sure. So he took me right up there, and I asked if I could take his picture. And he said, I would be very pleased. He was very, you know, charming and polite. I could see Duke of Duchess of Windsor. She was in a car. She had got her in the picture. She was looking out the car window. But this fellow that took me up there wanted his picture with the Duke, so he was standing, and that's the reason he took me there. He thought, knew I had a camera, so he was standing there with him. But when the pictures were developed, I wasn't very good at aiming it, and I had kind of left him out. Well, he wasn't happy with me at the end. Oh, dear.
Oh, okay.
Well, then, also, I visited the Nuremberg, had the good fortune to visit the Nuremberg trials
one time. Were you there when a trial was actually
was in process. And this was during the times I was riding the trains, and I guess I went to Nuremberg and was there for a day or so. So, yes, I went in, and that was very interesting. Of course, they do that all the time, but this was done in so many different languages, and so we each could, we had earphones, and you heard, and these interpreters were standing right, or sitting right up there, and you heard the whole process in your language, you know, and of course I heard it in English, and because it was so, and that amazed me, those interpreters, they could interpret so fast right along with it.
You don't remember who was interviewed at the time? Anyone? It wasn't anyone as prominent as Klaus Barbie or any. Oh no, he wasn't. That's
well,
right.
It was,
he was
one of the
protected by the Americans, wasn't he? Because
yeah.
He knew a lot of things we wanted.
Right. It was one of those, and I have that had charge of publicity or something with the with the young people. And he was on trial at the time, and he was one of the bigger shots in the
German
Reich. And I don't, we were only there one afternoon, you know, and listened to it, but I thought that was very interesting.
The building itself is rather austere, isn't it?
Yes.
I was surprised, as I remember, wooden floors, no carpeting.
Right, yeah. And I can remember Goering sitting in the, you know, they had all the ones that were on trial just sitting there waiting for their turn or something. I can remember seeing him in the box there, but waiting for them. So,
What was the atmosphere? Very solemn, was it not?
Yes, I would say it was.
And, I can understand
And the different, you know, lawyers were trying to get them off, but I think this particular one that I'm just sorry I can't remember his name, was convicted, you know, at the end, because I followed that up. Then while I was in Salzburg, I know that we gave a party for the children of the dependents, one Halloween party in our club, and by this time, you see, the teachers were over there, and they enjoyed that. We had a party, probably about 20 children, and they really, these are the American children, of course. On Christmas time at the club, we gave a party for the Austrian children and children of those that worked there. We had a party for 500 youngsters in the club. Of course, they couldn't speak English, but they enjoyed themselves, and one of the fellows dressed up as Santa Claus and had the children on his lap, and
it
was fun.
Big enough to be Santa Claus? I mean, wrote.
Yes, we kind of fixed him up.
You didn't have to use pillows?
Well, I think we did, yeah, somewhat.
The army keeps the men pretty.
Yeah, pretty thin. But they, of course, had their. Like I remember on the 6th of December is
St. Nicholas.
Yes. And well, it had
And he tells the children they better be good or they're going to be thrown in the
and
river.
And they came through with one had a switch. It wasn't St.
Yes.
Nicholas that was
the children
getting
were
out
scared
the
of him.
This was somebody driving out the spirits, the bad spirits. They went into the club with a switch, and they had quite a few of their native customs
as
at Christmas,
I remember,
which are different than ours.
He dresses in white, doesn't he?
Well,
and he tells the children he'll put them in a sack and throw them in the river, and I understand this custom is being frowned upon today.
Yes.
Even back 30 years ago, they were trying to discourage it. because the children were scared stiff.
Yes, they were. Uh-huh. Yeah, they did that, and that was interesting for me, of course. The other thing that, of course, the black market was so rampant at the time, and we didn't have to worry about, especially if you didn't smoke, and we were allowed a carton of cigarettes a week, and so you could use that for tipping, just a few cigarettes, you could get a whole lot done, bags carried or anything. For a carton of cigarettes, I had my laundry done, and every week, and did a beautiful job, and cleaned up your room a little bit, and then of course you could turn your cigarettes into the local money marks, and then turning that in turn to the script they had, and turn that and go back and into America, send it back home as a money order, and for a carton of cigarettes turned into several hundred dollars when the time you got home, if you wanted to. That went on for several months before the Army could get a hold control of that. And everything was, the black market was played heavily over there.
Now, is it about time for you to come home from overseas?
I'd been over there at this time over 2 years, and it was 1947 in the spring when they changed the clubs. They were slowly changing them over to civilian
clubs.
USO, or I guess
yes,
it was called,
I
over there.
Yes, I remember going to this club in Austria, too. We met there, had dinner there. I think we could stay overnight there. This is when the teachers from Trieste were transferred from Trieste to some other assignment.
And so, and for me, of course, I was ready to come home. My mother died in July of 7th of 1947, and in the meantime, they couldn't get me home. The Red Cross, even though I was in Red Cross, in time for the funeral. So then I wasn't in such a big hurry. I mean, I couldn't get home for the funeral. So, but they were already changing over. The clubs.
Did you get your notice immediately of the death?
Well, I knew that she was dying, and that I talked to someone.
Right.
Yes, and I talked
to
one.
Long distance?
I called home then. I had called early. I talked to my mother in March. By that time they had set up long distance so that we could do that.
Oh, you could telephone.
So I could telephone. They knew that I was going to call or waiting for it. I mean, it had all been arranged, and I think I talked several minutes.
I didn't have these facilities when my brother died in 1949 in Tokyo. Uh-huh. In fact, I didn't get the message. It was 1952, I believe. I didn't get the message for 5 days after I had died.
Hmm. Well, I knew. I talked to my mother in March of 1947, and. My mother and I had talked with my mother's friend, who let me know how serious it was, and I tried to get permission to get home, but they couldn't do the thing fast enough, and she passed away on the 7th. So I had telephone communications. Then by this time they were changing over in the clubs, so I had put in my to go home, but I didn't really get home until September of 47. It was all summer, slowly processing to get.
Your assignment terminated, or had you decided to leave?
I asked more
you
or less
to leave.
Uh huh. But I still had a choice. Some of them went to Vienna, that little club. I could have stayed a little longer, but they were pretty much winding down, and I had been over there enough time, and I wanted to get home, of course,
there were
for
men
personal.
Still over there waiting to go home in 1947.
But no, they had re-enlisted and they were staying there because of that. No, they had sent all those home that really wanted to go home long before that.
I see.
No, there was the re-enlistments by this time.
Now, when you went home, what did you do then?
Well, I came home on the Washington, it was the name of a little tugboat. I mean, it was much smaller than the Queen Elizabeth. Took 2 weeks coming home.
2 weeks?
On the boat coming home, and we went over in 5 days on the Queen Elizabeth.
Uh-huh.
And, it was a leisurely trip home.
Well, did it rock and roll, the little ships?
Yeah, right.
Make you seasick much easier than a larger ship.
Right. So I visited in Washington, D.C. I was at no hurry exactly to, you know, get home. I knew there was a lot waiting for me to do. But there was quite a lot of adjustment to make, let's say. And some of the girls had been over there a year and wanted to go home. You know, they were, and then when they got home, they found things weren't like they thought they might be, and they wanted to go back. So some of those re-enlisted and got sent to the Pacific or something. But, I mean, I had decided to stay over there till I got out of my system. I mean, that's it. I did everything I thought I could do. So when I went home, I was ready. Home was Lansing.
Lansing, Michigan.
Yes. And when I got here, my brother was, he had been in the Pacific, but he had gotten home months ahead of me, of course, a year, I guess. But mother was very ill and died. He hadn't done a thing to the house. He hadn't put away her clothes or, you know, anything. So when I got home, I had all, and also the house was in poor condition. We had, on St. Joe in Lansing. And they were remodeling it. But on the phone, when I called my brother, I was in the States, of course, then, and I said, well, I suppose there's a lot of dishes waiting and everything in the sink. And he said, well, there's no sink. And so that's how, it really was a sad house. Much to do, which in a way was very good for me, because when I did get home and I had to go through mother's thing, it's just as if she had left, you know, on a trip or something. And yes, and he hadn't touched anything. I had to go through, and you know, it took months. And and also he was working on the house and getting it. I don't think I worked for 6 or 7 months. And then I applied at the Howard Sobers, which was a trucking, and worked there 2 years, I believe, before I got married and went to Wichita, Kansas.
Rosalie, did you have any problems readjusting yourself when you came back to the States?
Yes, and I think all of the girls that were overseas did. Some of them had far more maybe adjustment to make than I did. As I say, I had so much to do and kept me busy, and some of them didn't have all those maybe problems to meet when they got home, and they just had a very rough time. When I got home, the thing that bothered me, nobody wanted to listen to me, to hear any of my wonderful experiences. And, I wanted to talk. They were, war had been over 2 years, and long gone for most people. They were, when I come home, I was still in my uniform. The uniforms were short, around the knee, and their dresses were longer then, much longer. I couldn't get out of my uniform fast enough because, I just didn't get all the respect that I'd had when I first went over. And as I say, no one was really interested in anything that happened over there, and that was a long, you know. Mm-hmm. So I never got out of my system, really. I'm being asked now to repeat all this. You know, it was about one of the first times anyone has really interested in what went on in those days.
So we were sort of left out when we came home, because we didn't know about the little gossip next door, so we couldn't contribute there. Nobody was interested in what we had to say, which was such a part of our background that it took some time to build a repertoire of new experiences.
Well, that's very true, and I don't think anyone that did serve overseas, or the soldiers too, of course, all went through that adjustment. But that is quite traumatic, and it's a shame that more people aren't willing maybe to listen, or at least pretend they're listening to us, because that's hard.
Thank you, Rosalie, so much for this interview. We really appreciate it. Well, by the way, before you we put a stop to this tape, you are a charter member of the Lansing unit of WOSL, aren't you?
Yes.
Do you happen to remember the year that we were established?
When I first got home from overseas, I was called. They were organizing it then, so this was in 1947. Would have been probably that winter of 47. No, that would be 48 then, wouldn't it? I might have been called in the fall of 47. Got home in September. They had a little small organization, maybe six or seven girls, and so I was a member until I got married, which was a year about later. Went to Wichita, Kansas. Was gone for a couple of years from Lansing. When I came back, by this time the group had grown a good deal, and I joined again.
Then when did you leave Lansing? What year?
I left this the second time?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
When you left permanently? I wouldn't say you left permanently. You return once in a while, but
when I went to Traverse. I went up there in 1968, spring of 68.
So you have been gone for
16 years.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Rosalie.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.